From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. President Trump tweets, Attorney General Jeff Sessions should end the Russia investigation right now. Obstruction or fighting back? Here's Press Secretary Sarah Sanders.
It's not an order. It's the president's opinion.
The president won't say it publicly, at least, but his top intelligence officials say Russia is a real threat to our democracy. Here's Dan Coats, Director of National Intelligence.
We acknowledge the threat. It is real. It is continuing. And we're doing everything we can to have a legitimate election that the American people can have trust in.
What did Ohio State's football coach know about his former assistant Zach Smith's abuse of his ex-wife? Plenty, says Courtney Smith. She is speaking out.
When somebody is crying out for help, I believe the coach, along with the coach's wife, have a duty. They have a duty to do something to help instead of worrying about winning game.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Eliana Johnson of Politico, Sahil Kapoor of Bloomberg News, and On Point's Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. Are you with the president or his top national security advisors on Russian interference? Are you persuaded either way in the Paul Manafort trial? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook. We're there, as always, at On Point Radio. Great panel today from Washington First, Eliana Johnson, White House reporter for Politico. Eliana, always great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Jane. Great to be with you.
Also in Washington, Sahil Kapoor, national politics reporter for Bloomberg News. Sahil, great to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me back.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Jane, Eliana, and Sahil.
So an extraordinary display yesterday, top U.S. national security officials standing side by side, vowing to defend American elections against what they called real and pervasive threats from Russia to undermine U.S. elections. Here is Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats. He said Russian interference in the U.S. political system is ongoing.
In regards to Russian involvement in the midterm elections, we continue to see a pervasive messaging campaign by Russia to try to weaken and divide the United States.
Eliana Johnson, start with you. Despite the president's willingness to accept Vladimir Putin's denials about Russia's involvement, there was no ambivalence there among Trump's top national security team.
That's right. And these statements come in the wake of a National Security Council meeting last week that the president chaired on election interference, which was an effort after the disastrous Helsinki summit where the president wouldn't denounce Vladimir Putin for meddling in the election. That was an effort by his national security aides to put the president in a position where he at least appeared to be doing something about election interference. But I think these statements raise the question, is there a centralized plan by these senior government officials to combat election interference? And the answer that we've gotten from these same officials when they've been asked about it in Capitol Hill testimony is that they haven't gotten together and made a plan, nor have they gotten an order from the president to get together and do something about this. So I think, though it's nice that they're denouncing interference, the question is, what's the plan to combat it?
Here's another denunciation. This is FBI Director Christopher Wray.
This is not just an election cycle threat. Our adversaries are trying to undermine our country on a persistent and regular basis, whether it's election season or not.
Sahil Kapoor, they were vague about how the government was actually responding to Eliana's point, though they did say President Trump had directed them in a national security meeting to aggressively confront these threats. So what do you say about that? And what do you know about is some sort of centralized plan to move forward here?
Yeah, they were vague for a reason, because there is no centralized directive from the top on what specifically to do to combat this stuff. There's FBI Director Christopher Wray saying that they're seeing foreign malign influence operations, essentially information warfare ahead of the 2018 elections. He also talked about potential penetration of voter registration databases. Unclear how precisely the federal government on an agency-wide basis is responding to this. And also on a legislative level, along with the president's, you know, doubts and splashing cold water on the intelligence committee's unanimous consensus that, it was Russia that meddled in 2016 and that it's happening again. There is an effort by House and Senate Democrats to pass a bill with $250 million in grants to states to beef up election security. It was blocked by the Republicans in both chambers. There is a bipartisan Senate bill by Marco Rubio and Chris Van Hollen to trigger sanctions on Russia if the Director of National Intelligence, not the president, the DNI, certifies that they've meddled in a future election. That also has not gone anywhere. So there's rhetoric happening. There's an attempt to show a united front. But in terms of action, a lot of this is still very dubious as to what's really happening.
So there they were, these top intelligence officials warning about Russia's interference in American elections. And then later that night, President Trump had a very different tone. This is from a campaign rally in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Here he is speaking about his relationship with Vladimir Putin.
We got along really well. By the way, that's a good thing, not a bad thing. That's a really good thing. Now, we're being hindered by the Russian hoax. It's a hoax, okay? I'll tell you what, Russia's very unhappy that Trump won, that I can tell you. But I got along great with Putin.
Jack Beatty, same day, two very different messages.
Yes, and he says Russia was unhappy that I won. Well, we all saw the press conference. We all heard Putin say we wanted Trump to win and we tried to help him win. That was the implication. So it's so obviously a false claim. You know, the president, someone tells Vanity Fair from the White House, with sources at the White House, that the Manafort trial is, quote, spinning him into a frenzy. One manifestation of that is what we saw at that rally. His false claims, his lies. They were averaging 7.6 a day in June and July, 16 a day. In Tampa, 35 false claims. In Wilkes-Barre last night, 16. He keeps saying, and in one day, July 5th, he made 79 false claims. There's something going on here, and I think Dr. Johnson put his finger on it when he said, credulity on the one part invites deceit on the other. His supporters, many Republicans, are just credulous. They believe him, and he deceives them.
So this does come as the Paul Manafort trial begins this week. Jack, you mentioned it. Paul Manafort on trial for 18 counts of conspiracy, tax and bank fraud. The trial enters its fourth day today, and prosecutors will focus on how Manafort lied about his income to acquire loans. But until now, much of the focus has been on Manafort's lavish spending. Here is CBS News correspondent Paula Reed.
A lot of this trial has been a bit like an episode of The Lifestyles in Rich and Famous. They're putting on these witnesses who worked at luxury men's clothing stores and having them describe all the items, the $21,000 watch, the $15,000 coat and vest made of ostrich, all of these things. And they sort of try to connect those luxury purchases to how they were paid for. And they also have people testifying that a lot of these items were paid for from accounts in Cyprus.
And yet, Eliana Johnson, there was some backlash to the focus on spending. Federal Judge T.S. Ellis III said to the prosecution yesterday, quote, don't show me closets full of clothing. He told prosecutors to not gild the lily as they seek Manafort's conviction. So, you know, essentially saying, don't worry about all the nice clothes and the rich stuff. There's, you know, get to the heart of this. If there's good stuff there, show it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I think for a lot of us who are watching this trial, essentially as lay people, those of us who aren't criminal attorneys, all of the details that the prosecution has been bringing forward are sort of fun and delicious. The $15,000 ostrich jacket and the oriental rugs and all of this stuff, because it's so foreign to all of us. And they're fun and memorable details. I don't think anybody will forget about this ridiculous ostrich coat, but it's not criminal to purchase an ostrich coat. And the judge is, I think, asking for hard evidence of criminality on the part of Manafort, and he wants to see where the tax fraud took place. And that's even separate from, I think, the problem for Mueller in this trial about how, in the end, the fact that Paul Manafort is, you know, committed tax fraud years before he joined, linked up with Donald Trump, really connects to Russian collusion.
Sahil Kapoor, Rick Gates, Manafort's business associate, is supposed to take the stand. That's the plan, at least. Remind us why that is significant.
Well, so Rick Gates worked with Manafort, and a big part of Manafort's strategy is to essentially point to Rick Gates and say he did it. Now, the prosecution is alleging, if we want to talk about a potential connection here, that a bank executive gave Manafort a sweetheart deal on millions of dollars in loans while seeking a position in the Trump campaign at the time. And the question that that obviously raises is that, did Manafort try to help him? Was there an improper quid pro quo? Now, Adam Davidson in The New Yorker has an interesting piece that argues that Manafort was in a desperate and self-destructive period in early 2016 when he joined the campaign. His main client, Viktor Yanukovych, in Ukraine had lost the presidency, and all of a sudden this gravy train of hundreds of thousands of dollars that were being transferred to the United States came to a screeching halt, which led to him taking all kinds of bizarre risks and allegedly committing crimes. And, you know, all of a sudden he was in the same room advising the man who'd soon become the most powerful person in the world. So what did he do? What kinds of risks did he take? And did he make any untoward and criminal moves?
So while this is happening, Trump's legal team is discussing the possibility of an interview with the president with special counsel Robert Mueller. Here's the president's attorney, Rudy Giuliani.
I've heard him say, I want to be interviewed if my lawyers can reach an agreement on what the ground rules will be. We've had a hard time doing that, but we're still, I'm not going to give you a lot of hope it's going to happen, but we're still negotiating. We haven't stopped negotiating with him.
In fact, they've been negotiating, Ileana Johnson, for months, the parameters of this interview for 8 months. Where does that stand in the context of Manafort and all the rest of it?
Yeah, Jane, this is so interesting because it was treated as big news this week that the president still wants to testify. But that's really not news. The president has always wanted to sit down with Robert Mueller and really believes, like with dictators, that the power of his personality can move the person across the table from him. But his lawyers have a moral and ethical right to protect their client, and they believe it would be absolutely self-destructive for him to testify. So they're doing everything in their power still, either to prevent him from doing so or to allow him to answer questions in writing rather than in person.
We are talking about the week in the news. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about a week in the news, a busy week in the news, from threats of a government shutdown to tensions between the president and the news media. You can join the conversation. Should the president shut the government down over a border wall? What about the president's renewed attack on the news media, on his daughter's pushback on that, and on his family separation policy? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. My guest today, Ileana Johnson, White House reporter for Politico. Sahil Kapoor, national politics reporter for Bloomberg News, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. So as the jury was hearing evidence in the Paul Manafort trial, the president, in a tweet, urged the attorney general this week, Jeff Sessions, to terminate the special counsel's investigation into the Russia campaign interference. He says Jeff Sessions should stop this rigged witch hunt right now before it continues to stain our country any further. Bob Mueller is totally conflicted, and his 17 angry Democrats that are doing his dirty work are a disgrace to the USA. Ileana Johnson, Sarah Sanders at the White House said this was not an order. It's the president's opinion. Trump's lawyer said the president was not ordering anybody to take any specific action. How did you see it? What was your reaction?
I actually think the press secretary is right in this case, given that Jeff Sessions is recused from the case and nobody at the Justice Department is taking any action about this. I think if the president were to treat this as an order, he would be moved to fire people for not obeying it. And it does actually, inappropriate as it is for him to be talking about this stuff, he's not taking action when people are not listening to him.
So Sahil, obstruction of justice here? I mean, or is the president just fighting back and has the right to do so?
Well, President Trump has a tendency to tweet and speak as though he's a passive observer of his own presidency, and that's what he seems to be doing here. I mean, the tweet doesn't make sense in the sense that, of course, Attorney General Sessions is recused and he is not overseeing the investigation, but it does continue to send a signal. Every time the president speaks, markets and foreign leaders and domestic agencies and lawmakers pay attention, and the lawmakers who are paying the closest attention are House conservative Republicans who are filing motions to try to impeach and remove Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who does oversee this investigation. And the more the president lashes out at the investigation, the more he sends tweets trying to undermine and delegitimize it, it provides fuel to his allies on Capitol Hill and in conservative media to continue that that crusade of undermining the legitimacy of this in the eyes of the public.
Jack Beatty, how did you see it?
Well, you see people saying, law professors saying this is obstruction of justice, is symbolically, even if the attorney general can't carry out the wish, it makes the wish clear. And experts on this all go to intent. The crucial thing in proving an obstruction of justice is, was there an intent to impede justice? And these tweets, going back, through the administration, but certainly the ones about Sessions going back more than a year, are being examined by the Mueller inquiry precisely as possible evidence of intention. Here's the president's sentiments. These are his views. These are, you could say, his intentions. And consistently, he has said, fire Mueller, or, this is a witch hunt, or the attorney general should do this, or I'm disappointed in the attorney general. He should protect me, not the Constitution, not the country. All of this is almost... The president is a terrible client. Let's put it that way. He keeps offering ammunition for the Mueller probe.
And Jane, if I could just add briefly, Rudy Giuliani, the president's lawyer, is openly making the argument now that it's not really obstruction if you're doing it right out in the open. He said to the New York Times, quote, "If you're going to obstruct justice, you do it quietly and secretly, not in public." Unquote.
Eliana Johnson.
I think Jack lays out the view of one group of legal scholars, and it will, if Mueller actually makes this case, it will open a fascinating debate between legal scholars who are of Jack's view that you can obstruct justice based on your intent, and another group of scholars who say it's fully within the president's right to fire Attorney General Sessions if he wants to. It was his right to fire James Comey, and it would be his right to shut down the Mueller probe if he wanted to, and that you can't obstruct justice based on what you were thinking when you did something that was part of your lawful presidential powers. Mm. And so I think that would be the sort of legal debate that this would open up if this is where Bob Mueller's going.
We shall see. Let me move on now to the president's comments about a government shutdown. This was at a campaign rally yesterday in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. President Trump repeating his claim that he would indeed shut down the government over funding for a border wall, despite warnings from Republicans not to do it before the midterm elections.
A lot of great Republicans, well-meaning. I don't mean like they're well-meaning. They say, look, we have the best economy ever. We're doing great. Maybe we don't want to complicate it. And I understand it. I'm a little torn myself. I would personally prefer before. But whether it's before or after, we're either getting it or we're closing down government. We need border security.
Sahil Kapoor, we're either getting a wall or we're shutting down the government. Is that an empty threat or a very real promise? How do you see it?
I would not assume that it's an empty threat. I think we've been at this place on a number of occasions before when Congress has to fund the government, and President Trump has threatened repeatedly that he would force a government shutdown if Congress doesn't fund his border wall, and he has stepped back from the brink at the last minute every time so far. Now, the more he does that, the harder it gets to step back from the brink the next time around, because at some point he's got to be able to tell his voters that I'm drawing the line here and I'm not going to let it, you know, continue to happen. Now, Republicans in Congress are very nervous about this. They have a midterm election coming up in just a couple of months, and the last thing they want is for a government, the government to shut down 6 weeks before the election, which would be on their watch. Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the White House. Before the Trump presidency, there had never been a government shutdown, at least in the modern era, since the 70s, when the government actually did shut down in the event of a funding lapse when one party controlled everything. So this is not something that party leaders want. They're going to try to talk him out of it. Whether they succeed remains to be seen.
So, Eliana Johnson, it is an interesting calculus at play here, for sure, coming right at the midterm elections.
Absolutely. The reason I don't think this is an empty threat is that when the president signed the omnibus bill this winter, he very quickly saw the negative news coverage that surrounded it on Fox News by folks who said the president was taken for a ride. This is the most irresponsible spending bill that's ever been signed, and so on. And he very quickly said he regretted signing that bill. He wasn't going to sign another bill like this. And he regretted it because there was a lot of spending that he didn't like in that bill, and he didn't get funding for the wall. And he said he wasn't going to let it happen again. And I think that's fresh in his mind as he approaches another spending deadline.
Jack Beatty's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell told reporters this week that he supports the president's border wall proposal. Do you see Mitch McConnell siding with the president on this to the very end, supporting a government shutdown?
In brief, no. It would be absurd and against the interest of the Republican Party. The president is hung up on this, possibly for what the psychological reasons that Eliana outlines. But it's a bootless strategy to even talk about shutting down the government.
So, Eliana, what's the timetable here? When might this happen, and when will we know?
You know, I think that this will be pushed until the very last minute because nobody gets things done in advance in Washington. And it's likely to go until the very end. Jack is right. Mitch McConnell absolutely does not want a government shutdown. He wants another spending bill. And I think it's important to note there are other folks in the administration, Mick Mulvaney, Larry Kudlow, who want to lower the spending levels in this bill from what they were previously. And that's another internal fight happening in the administration. So I don't think we're going to know until the fall the way this is going to shake out. And funding for the wall is not the only fight happening. There are fights between Kudlow, Mulvaney, and McConnell happening over domestic spending.
Mm. Not just fights in Washington. I wanted to talk about the president's renewed campaign against the news media this week. He called the news media the fake, disgusting news. We've heard that before, but it was different this week. This was at a Make America Great Again rally in Tampa, Florida on Tuesday. The supporters of the president heckled CNN reporter Jim Acosta. President Trump later retweeted those jeers.
CNN sucks! CNN sucks! CNN sucks!
Yesterday, President Trump's daughter Ivanka said that the news media is not the enemy of the people. And at a White House press conference later that afternoon, CNN reporter Jim Acosta asked the press secretary, Sarah Sanders, multiple times whether she agrees.
The president of the United States should not refer to us as the enemy of the people. His own daughter acknowledges that. And all I'm asking you to do, Sarah, is to acknowledge that right now and right here.
I appreciate your passion. I share it. I've addressed this question. I've addressed my personal feelings. I'm here to speak on behalf of the president. He's made his comments clear.
Eliana Johnson, what did you see this week? These crowds with the chants, giving reporters the middle finger. What do you see in this animus toward the news media? Do you see it escalating?
I'm not sure I see it escalating. I think we saw a lot of that on the campaign trail. It's unseemly and unpleasant. Sahil and I have been the subject of it. But I do think there were times when it was like a little bit frightening, I have to say, on the campaign trail. But as long as it doesn't escalate into physical action, I think people are perfectly within their rights to say those sorts of things. I think it's a point where there's a concern that it's going to escalate into some sort of physicality or violence that is a concern. And I do think reporters should be very careful to vocalize that's a concern. I think people are perfectly within their rights to say whatever they want and to jeer the media. It's fine.
So it was interesting at the podium yesterday at the White House, Sarah Sanders Speaking about this, she said, quote, "The media has attacked me personally on a number of occasions, including your own network." Here is that she's speaking about CNN. When I hosted the Correspondents Association, there was a comedian there. She talked about attacking her appearance, called her a traitor to her gender. In fact, Jack Beatty, she's the first press secretary in the history of the U.S. that's required Secret Service protection. So there she is, Sarah Sanders, saying, you know, there are two sides to this story here, Jack.
Yes, but the Washington Post looks at her claims, and on the comedian, they point out that the journalists themselves were alarmed and expressed dismay over the comedian's comments. And on other things that Sarah brought up, you know, the best that they could point to would be comments someone made on cable television, which were taken, at least as the Post lays it out, wildly out of context to allow Sarah to have this moment of self-pity. You know, this phrase, "enemies of the people," it's a Stalinist phrase. Nikita Khrushchev denounced it in his 1956 secret speech to the Communist Party, where he was making a sort of, you know, putting the sins of Stalinism out. And he said this, that the phrase "enemies of the people," quote, "was specifically introduced for the purpose of physically annihilating those who disagreed with Stalin." Physically annihilating. It is a blood-soaked phrase, and to apply it to reporters and to the media in a year when we have seen, after all, you know, journalists killed for being journalists, is playing with fire.
I'm going to get a call on this point from Providence, Rhode Island. Matt is on the line. Hi, Matt. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Good.
Yeah, I'd like to continue on Jack Beatty's point. I think we've reached the point where it's incumbent on you in the news media to make clear that what is happening now is the beginning of something. The previous guest said everyone's within their rights to say these things, sure, but the president and this administration are goading people into action.
Matt, thank
you. And it's obvious every day. Yeah.
Sahil, do you want to jump in here, respond to all this?
Sure. So just a few days ago, the New York Times publisher says he told the president that his anti-press rhetoric was increasingly dangerous and warned specifically that it will lead to violence. Now, it is true that Sarah Sanders has been on the receiving end of some attacks. You can argue that many of them are unfair, but there's a big difference when you're the figurehead, when you're the spokesperson for the United States government, to essentially be, you know, refusing to disagree with the idea that the press is the enemy of the people. The president has said that. It now seems to be the official position of the White House. The way he delineates these things is also very curious to me. He's called CNN fake news. He's singled them out over and over again. While he has said warm things about Alex Jones, who is a conspiracy theorist who said things like the Sandy Hook massacre was staged, that is the absolute epitome of egregious fake news. And, you know, the president doesn't seem to be criticizing that. So I there's just a lot of questions about where he's coming from, what his priorities are in this regard, and whether it is actually fake news and hoaxes that he's against, or whether it's criticism that he's trying to snuff out and delegitimize of himself.
Matt, thank you very much for that call. We're going to break here in just a couple of minutes. Eliana Johnson, you wrote a piece this week about Chief of Staff John Kelly, who President Trump said this week will remain in his job until 2020. Tell us your reporting on that point.
You know, the point I made in the piece was that there's been a lots of speculation and analysis about Kelly's influence waning. But I actually think right now that this is sort of the best of both worlds for the president, where he has a chief of staff, and the White House itself emphasizes that he runs the staff rather than manage the president. And I think that's something that the president that works perfectly for the president, where he's not fettered in any way by his chief of staff, which is completely atypical for somebody in the role of chief of staff. But he has somebody to blame if something goes terribly awry. So this seems to be a relationship that's working for Trump. And the day after my piece was published, he asked Kelly to stay on through 2020. Hmm.
And quickly, Sahil Kapoor, before the break, jobs numbers out this morning. More good news, a steady stream of hiring gains in this economy, robust economic growth, 157,000 jobs added to the economy. Unemployment rate fell to 3.9%. This is Donald Trump's economy now, and it's doing very well, Sahil.
Right. The stock market is booming. Corporate profits are soaring. We are in an extended period of economic expansion, a pretty remarkable and lengthy one. Now, the critique of the economy at the moment is that real wages and incomes are still sluggish. They actually rose much faster in between 2014 and 2016, according to the St. Louis Fed. Home sales are declining. Interest rates are rising. So there are some warning signs. And that is what, President Trump's critics will point out. But for now, there's plenty for the White House and for his allies to celebrate about the economy.
Sure is. We are discussing the week in the news this hour. Great panel. Ileana Johnson, White House reporter for Politico. She's in Washington. Also in Washington, Sahil Kapoor, national politics reporter for Bloomberg News. Our own Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst, with us as well. And listeners, we'd love to have you. You can join us. Do you want higher tariffs on China, as high as 25%? What do you make of those? Are you ready to freeze auto emission standards? The president is. We'll talk about that next. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. More to come. We'll be right back.
I'm Ann Powers from NPR Music. Last summer, we launched Turning the Tables, a project that radically changed how we talk about the history of popular music, with a list of the 150 greatest albums by women. This week, we're launching Season 2, looking at the 200 greatest songs by 21st century women. Check out who made the list and who didn't at n.pr/turningthetables.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. In other news this week, more than 100 people, 100 passengers and crew members, that was everyone on board, survived a plane crash in Mexico. Here's the survivor talking to CNN.
People die when planes crash. And here I am as a survivor taking another plane. The lady in front of me held my arm because I was sobbing.
Protests in Zimbabwe turned violent on Wednesday after some called the nation's elections rigged. At least 6 people are dead.
People are being beaten by the soldiers. Some of our guys have been killed. It's not safe. It's not safe.
And late night host Stephen Colbert spoke about sexual assault and harassment allegations against his boss, CBS honcho Leslie Moonves.
He hired me to sit in this chair. He stood behind this show while we were struggling to find our voice. He gave us the time and the resources to succeed. And he has stood by us when people were mad at me. And I like working for him. But accountability is meaningless unless it's for everybody, whether it's the leader of a network or the leader of the free world.
You can join the conversation, listeners. What's moving your world this week? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Great panel today. Ileana Johnson, White House reporter for Politico. Sahil Kapoor, national politics reporter for Bloomberg News. And On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. President Trump escalated his trade war with China this week, ordering his administration to consider more than doubling proposed tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods. The tariff would rise to 25% from 10% that the president originally wanted. Ileana Johnson, what did you see in that move this week?
You know, the trade war with China is really the only one of these tariffs or trade wars that I think has widespread congressional support and public support. The president put the trade war with the EU on the back burner when he reached an agreement with EU President Jean-Claude Juncker last week when he was in the States on a visit. And so I think the president, he sees this as following through on a campaign promise. This is something that he's believed all his life. And he's going to stick to his guns on this. And I would note, I would link this to what we talked about in the last segment, which is the improving numbers in the economy, which I think are only going to steal the president's resolve because he's not seeing any economic costs to tariffs, which are something that Republicans really warn him about, particularly in the run-up to the midterm elections.
Sahil Kapoor, just this morning, China said it will impose tariffs on $60 billion of U.S. goods if the U.S. presses ahead with this increase of tariffs to 25%. There are fissures within Trump's own team on this, are there not?
There are certainly fissures within Trump's team on this. There are fissures within the Republican Party, deepening ones over the issue of trade and tariffs. Just this week, we are seeing a war between the Koch brothers, who are billionaire financiers that have traditionally supported conservative and Republican causes, and politicians who are openly, taking aim at the White House, refusing to give to some Republican candidates. They are running ads pressuring the White House to reverse course on the tariffs. Now, with the issue of China, Eliana is exactly right that many members of Congress on both sides of the aisle support confronting China, whether it's their currency manipulation or their predatory dumping of goods designed to hurt domestic American markets. Trump has a viable argument here that it was China that started this trade war.
Yes.
The question is, what is the end game here? China is strategically targeting the United States almost as if to deliberately hurt Trump where he's most vulnerable by targeting soybeans and auto. I think this is going to hurt a lot of farmers in states like Missouri and Tennessee and Indiana and North Dakota. I spoke to some of them in Tennessee when I was there last week, and they're very nervous about the impacts of this. So where is this going to lead? Is this just going to be, shooting in the dark in the hope that something is good is going to come of it? Or is there an end game here? And it's not clear there is an end game.
You mentioned the Koch brothers. Over the weekend, billionaire and notable Republican donor Charles Koch released a video attacking President Trump's trade, his policies, which stirred backlash from the president.
When people act in protectionist ways, they erect barriers, which makes everyone worse off. The urge to protect ourselves from change has doomed many countries throughout history. And this protectionist mindset has destroyed countless businesses as well.
Jack, on Tuesday, President Trump tweeted, quote, "I have never sought their support," meaning the Koch brothers, "because I don't need their money or their bad ideas." That's quite something to hear from Charles Koch on this.
Yes, yes. Of course, historically, he's right. I mean, tariffs, that's flat earth economics. And the distress one hears from various parts of the U.S. economy testify that, at least in part, this trade war on China is a war on American workers and employers. By week's end, Charles Koch was back on side because the president is going to, the EPA announced relaxing the admission standards that President Obama had worked out with the car companies, and the big beneficiaries of that, according to studies, the oil companies. One estimate is that this change of lowering mileage standards and so on could mean $600 billion more for the oil companies, of which Koch Industries is a proud representative.
Let me move to immigration now, because according to court documents filed this week, the Trump administration now believes that the responsibility for finding parents who were deported after they were separated from their children should rest with immigration advocacy groups and not with the federal government. The administration reunited more than 1,400 kids with their parents by that deadline in July, July 26 deadline that was imposed by a U.S. district judge. But an estimated 431 kids are still separated from their parents, Eliana Johnson, and it looks like the administration now says the work of reuniting these kids now falls to groups outside of the government, groups like the ACLU. Is that what you're taking here? Is that what that meant?
Yes, this is sort of the latest mind-bending twist in what has really been a disaster for the Trump administration. But I would note sort of, I think, one that has fallen out of the headlines, more or less. And I think that that's what the administration is hoping for, because this really was a policy that the administration was not prepared to execute. And the reuniting, I would note, was going to have to be done whether the administration followed through with the zero tolerance policy or not. They ended up not following through with it, but it shows how absolutely unprepared the administration was to execute its own policy in the first place.
Here is Ivanka Trump at an Axios event in Washington yesterday. She is speaking about this family separation policy of her father's, this policy at the border.
That was a low point for me as well. I feel very strongly about that. And I am very vehemently against family separation and the separation of parents and children.
So Sahil Kapoor, there's Ivanka Trump. Meanwhile, the ACLU has complained that the government is not even sharing information it already has on parents who have been deported, mostly to Central American nations of Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, places like that. I mean, what do you make of this new twist in this really difficult story?
It's a mess for the Trump administration. I mean, it wasn't the ACLU or immigrant rights groups that, you know, executed this policy in the first place. They opposed it. So it's a bit of a difficult argument to now put the responsibility on them. But this is something that the administration clearly wants to turn the page on. They have made very serious efforts to reunite these children with, you know, with their parents after this became a national black mark on the presidency. Two-thirds of children between the ages of 5 and 17 have been reunited. As far as the other one-third goes, hundreds of parents have already been deported, and the United States government doesn't track them after they've been deported. So there's no, you know, there's no real end in sight for some of these children who haven't seen their parents in a while and may not. The key thing to remember here, I think, is that this was a policy that the White House put in place deliberately designed to inflict pain on people who were trying to cross the border illegally. It was about sending a message, a deterrent, according to White House Chief of Staff John Kelly. Attorney General Sessions said, if people cross the border illegally, bad things are going to happen. They were going to carry out the law, and it's not our fault if they get separated. Now, this went south, in terms of the PR impact of this. Once all these images came out, once all these horrific, audio came out of children who were separated, and the administration decided to reverse course.
Let's get a caller in here from Orlando, Florida on this point. Rufus has been holding and wants to get in here. Rufus, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My comment regards the wall, and just really had enough of hearing about the wall as though people were just pouring over the border because there's no wall, and that's a misnomer. I wanted to just make the point that if we really wanted to do some real immigration reform, we would hold organizations and companies accountable that hire or that employ or utilize undocumented workers in less than low wages. For that, I mean, I'm in Central Florida.
Mm-hmm.
You can go all around the tourist area, and these vegetable industries that hire lots of undocumented workers, and we buy their products. And to me, if we really wanted some real immigration reform, we would come up with monetary fines and penalties to these companies that bring in these workers to do the work that paid less than minimum wage that many Americans won't do.
Right. Rufus, thank you very much for that call. Let me get Christopher in here on another point on this matter. Christopher in Sublette, Kansas. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Yeah, I would just like to say, to piggyback off what the gentleman before me said, let's be honest here, the Midwest would shut down. We've got immigrants in this country for the best reasons, right, to support their families back home. I just got done telling them, how is somebody from Guatemala who makes $1 a day supposed to afford to come to the U.S. legally? I mean, are they just supposed to show up to the border and pay a tutor to teach them the history of America that they're going to have to take on the citizenship test that most citizens can't even pass themselves who were born here? That is just absolutely absurd.
Christopher, thank you. Jack Beatty, you know, it all comes down to immigration policy and not much movement on some legislation that moves us toward some point where not many of us agree, but still needs to happen, obviously.
And, of course, it could have happened any time in the last 4 or 5 years. The Senate passed a comprehensive immigration bill under President Obama with Republican support. It included, to bring up Rufus's point, a tough E-Verify regime that would do what he wants, fine employers, make it a severe matter to hire illegal undocumented workers. It was not brought to the floor in the House because it would have passed. So, in other words, there's been a deliberate effort by House conservatives to stop the national consensus, there does seem to be a national consensus, to work out a comprehensive solution to immigration. This has been going on year after year with House conservatives just saying no.
Well, let me move on now to the Trump administration's plans to freeze anti-pollution and fuel efficiency standards in this country for cars, automobiles, significantly weakening one of President Obama's signature policies to combat global warming. Eliana Johnson, what did you see this week in the administration's proposals on this important matter that, frankly, a lot of people really care about?
Yeah, a couple of things. I mean, the Trump administration has really prided itself on rolling back where it could executive actions, particularly on the agency level, that the Obama administration put into place. But the second thing that I think was noteworthy is that the EPA post Scott Pruitt is going to be very similar to the EPA under Scott Pruitt. I think this is one of the first major actions that we've seen them take under the new administrator. And so that was significant to me.
Jack Beatty, your thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, as I said, it's going to be a boon for the petroleum industry. And, you know, you have to wonder. Red states breathe the air, too. You know, they have Republican voters have children who are hostages to a polluted future. Global warming happens where they are as well. And yet, this boon to oil lobbyists is something that essentially is at the expense of the whole country, and even the car companies are saying, "Wait a minute, now, you can't keep sending us these shifting signals." California, are you going to? Is all that litigation to prevent California and 23 other states from having their own standards, is that going to go ahead or not? They don't know. They seem to want to have this thing worked out and not, benefit from. They don't see themselves as benefiting from this block on innovation in the automobile industry. The only beneficiaries, fossil fuels.
Sahil Kapoor, about a minute left here. I want to get you in here on a piece you wrote this week on a primary, an important primary down in Tennessee. Tell us about that and why it was significant.
Right. So the table was set yesterday after the candidates, Democrat Phil Bredesen and Republican Marsha Blackburn, won their primaries. They both faced very little opposition. This is the seat to fill to succeed retiring Senator Bob Corker, who's one of President Trump's biggest critics. The strategies here are very interesting. Marsha Blackburn is trying to nationalize the race, emphasize her party affiliation, talk about how this could be the seat, and it very well could be that decides who controls the Senate. Phil Bredesen is a former governor of the state. He's popular there. He's known as a pragmatist, and he's trying to de-emphasize his party label and his national and the national implications of the race as much as possible. He's trying to localize it. He has promised to support President Trump when he says his policies are right for Tennessee and oppose him when he's wrong. This is the wild card in the deck, I think, of the 2018 midterm elections, because if Democrats can win this seat, which, this state, which voted for Trump by 26 points, has not sent a Democrat to the Senate since 1990, it suggests the kind of national climate where they can retake the Senate, even in a very tough year.
Sahil Kapoor, national politics reporter for Bloomberg News. Sahil, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Eliana Johnson, White House reporter for Politico. Always great to get your perspectives, Eliana. Thank you.
Thanks, Jane.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst. Jack, thank you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Jane.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poley, James Ross, and our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Thanks for being with us, listeners. I'm Jane Clayson. Have a great weekend. This is On Point.